Loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We go inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker. Over the weekend, the Saudi monarchy carried out a mass execution of 47 people, including Shiite clerical leader Nimr al-Nimr. Others of the executed were human rights activists, while others, too, were said to be linked to al-Qaeda. Mass protests erupted in Tehran, the capital city of Iran, and the Saudi embassy in Tehran was torched. In response, the Saudis expelled the Iranian ambassador, and tensions between the two countries are at a boiling point. Scores of armed supporters of Oregon rancher Dwight Hammond and his son Stephen, both of whom were sentenced to 5 years in prison by a federal appeals court, have carried out the armed seizure of a federal building in a remote part of Oregon. Finally, the police who shot 12-year-old Tamir Rice in Cleveland, who was shot dead while playing by himself on a playground, will not be prosecuted. Upon this announcement, people took to the streets throughout the United States. But first, let's turn to Saudi Arabia. We are joined in studio by Ali Al-Ahmed, the founder and director of the Institute for Gulf Affairs. He was jailed at the age of 14 by the Saudi government, making him, at that time, the youngest political prisoner in the country's history. Welcome, Ali.
Thank you for having me.
The first question, I want to start by asking you this. Who was executed? What were they doing? Why were they imprisoned? And why now?
The executed people is, of the 47 people who were executed on Saturday, were a mix. And I think that was intentional. They mixed protesters, religious leaders with Al-Qaeda operatives and Al-Qaeda advocates. For example, among those who were executed, al-Wahhabi cleric named Faris al-Zahrani, who was advocating but not involved himself in any violence, yet he was executed because he described the Saudi state as illegitimate. This is very similar to what Sheikh Nimr said, that, you know, we cannot be ruled by a family. We are free people. Although these people are apart in terms of where they come from, Sheikh Nimr and Mr. Shuail, but both expressed their opinions. They did not involve themselves in violence. So among the others were protesters, like the young ones, the Shia protesters. Others in the Sunni side were also executed for their opinions. Others were, in fact, involved in violence. But one must realize that these trials and the process these people went through does not meet any international standards. The Saudi court system does not rise to the level to be called a justice system, because it's an apartheid court system that limits the judges to one strand of Islam, to Wahhabi Muslims. Shia Muslims, Sunni Muslims, secular Muslims are not allowed to be judges, prosecutors, or even investigators. So you are talking about very much the Saudi version of Jim Crow. So you cannot trust the outcome in these courts. The court system also is owned and operated by the Saudi government, its security apparatus, and it's not independent. The judges are not well trained to be judges. The sentences were ordered by the government, not through a fair and just trial and procedure.
This was, what you're saying, essentially political, not legal.
Absolutely. This is a political decision to execute these people. It was made by the highest authority in the Saudi.
And that makes me ask, again, the second part of my first question, why and why now?
Why? Because the Saudi government is in trouble. They have just released a few days ago their annual budget, which is a miserable budget. It has a huge deficit. The budget has shrunk. They had to increase taxes on the population. Among the few times that they have to do that, they increased energy prices. and they are set to add taxes because the revenue has shrunk due to the oil prices and due to, obviously, to the mismanagement and corruption of the ruling family. The people in that country are demanding more from the ruling family, from the monarchy. And this is a monarchy that's losing its war in Yemen, that its stance in Syria has been challenged by the Russians and even the Americans, that it has really lost almost all the battles that it has waged.
So, but are you saying, in other words, that the execution of this very important Shiite cleric, and of course the Shiites are a minority within Saudi Arabia, although the human rights side has Shiites and Sunnis. In other words, it's not simply a sectarian or religious-based movement for human rights or for democracy. But are you saying that the execution of this leader, of this clerical leader, Nimr al-Nimr, and the others was essentially for domestic consumption? In other words, the politics of diversion from a monarchy?
Absolutely.
More than, say... a regional effort by the Saudis perhaps to sabotage a resolution in Syria or to break up any possible thaw between the U.S. and Iran. I mean, you think it's fundamentally domestic?
Yes, it's domestic because they needed to deflect. The Saudi monarchy is they're the masters of deflection. When there is when they find themselves in a bind, they create another distraction. And I think that now people in that country are not talking about the economic crises in the country. They're talking about these executions. The Saudis did not stop where they executed people. So they went ahead and created this confrontation with the Iranians. The Iranians, if you remember, three months ago, when they lost over 400 pilgrims in the Hajj stampede, they did not create a crisis with the Saudis. They were angry, but they did not create crisis. But now the Saudis over storming of their embassy, which is wrong, by the way, but they created this basically false crisis, created this crisis with the Iranians to distract, again, to deflect.
To create a nationalist sentiment against Iran.
They needed to their political base, power base, to focus, to rally behind them, and they wanted some regional support for that. Remember, they created this alliance to invade and bomb Yemen, and this has failed. They are trying to create this so-called Islamic alliance to fight terrorism. It hasn't gone nowhere. It is more sound than reality. So this is another attempt to get the supporters to rally behind the ruling family after their continuous or consecutive losses.
The United States has seen Saudi Arabia as a principal, enduring, decades-long ally, perhaps at one time an extension almost of American power. I think Ronald Reagan said, I can't remember the exact quote, but paraphrasing, in the early 1980s after the Iranian Revolution of 1979, there just won't be a revolution in Saudi Arabia, meaning one way or the other, the United States would stop it. I know you'll know the quote better than I. But I'm wondering, does this help the United States? I mean, it seems if the Saudis are doing something for domestic political consumption, they're creating this huge crisis with Iran. But at the same time, the United States has attempted perhaps playing catch up. I'd say playing catch up is the right word. At Vienna 2 and through other international symposiums and summits, to try to find some international and regional cooperation against ISIL, the so-called Islamic State, both in Syria and Iraq. Did the United States, with its special relationship with Saudi Arabia, know that the executions were coming? And did they say anything to stop it?
I can tell you they knew about the executions because I told them. I provided evidence. I wrote an article about it several weeks ago. And I warned from in the same language, probably they used it from my article, that instability and tension in the region will be exacerbated by such an action. It was important for the U.S. if they wanted stability in Saudi Arabia itself, forget the region, they would have gotten on the phone and made sure these executions did not happen. Executing people doesn't really solve a problem. The U.S. relationship with Saudi Arabia is changing. because now there is the rise of Iran, political, economic, and the decline of the Saudis. And I think that that was almost a desperate move by the Saudis to regain some of that momentum that they have lost. And they were looking for the United States support, but I don't think they got the support they needed. They might have gotten some, but not...
Certainly no big deal, harsh condemnation from the Obama administration or its spokespersons about this. They expressed some concern, as far as I could see. I mean, could they be supporting the Saudi move here? Does the U.S. support it?
I think I think the United States, the advisors to the president, are mostly unaware, and they do not know the region very well. And you see that happening again and again. And I think that's maybe the fault of having political appointments, not professional diplomats to explain these things. And you find people, because they gave money, their kids are writing briefs to the president, and they cannot even spell the names of the regional leaders. And I think as a lame duck president, I don't think he cares very much. And that's reflective in what the White House said today.
Ali Al-Akhmad, you are a well-known human rights champion for Saudi Arabia here in Washington, D.C. You stood up for the people in Bahrain. You stood up for the democracy movement throughout the Gulf states where the monarchies rule. You said you told the Obama administration that the executions could happen and that they should try to stop them. Besides writing an article, did you communicate directly?
Yes, directly. I mean, this was an addition to speaking directly and having several meetings and saying, this is very serious.
With
State Department. I can't give you names, but with State Department, and I wrote an official letter and had direct face-to-face meeting. And I said, here are the information, talk to these people. And, you know, this is the way to stop it. You must make it clear to the Saudis that you are not going to be happy and this will affect the relationship. And I said, this is good for the United States. I've always said that the U.S., the best role that the U.S. could play in the region is the peacemaker. If the United States sent peace envoys instead of bombs and planes, I don't think we will have a region.
Well, that piece of advice they have not listened to.
Not yet.
Okay. So... And with that said, since Obama became president in 2009, January, the United States has sold $50 billion, and a billion is a lot of money, as you know, $50 billion in weapons to this monarchy. It's a tyranny. There's no democracy. It's ruling with an iron fist. What's driving U.S. policy? Is it politics? Is it the using the Saudis or... just ignorance, as you say, may be partly the cause? Or is there the military-industrial complex behind it that's actually very much profiting from a relationship with Saudi Arabia?
I think the industrial-military complex is a contributing factor. But also we have to realize that the people in power in this country, this is an open political system that it is influenced by money. And the Saudis figured that out, and they are giving money to the Clinton Foundation, to the Carter Foundation, to others through either gifts or through financial arrangements and contracts. So that is very important. People, they say in America, there is no free lunch. And I think Obama maybe is thinking about after the presidency, it would be nice for him to get a few million dollars from the Saudis. And that affects his statements and his policy. That's very clear to me. I'm not accusing anybody of anything, but this is very clear to me with the Clinton and others who were not willing to challenge the Saudis on many things, including terrorism against the United States. So the Obama administration is mistaken to continue this policy, because this hurts the United States standing in the region, and I think they should change it.
Well, if you have some entity, a foreign entity coming and giving very, very, very large, generous donations, like to the Clinton Foundation or to other major political entities in the United States, and then you say there's no free lunch, meaning there's some strings attached to that money.
Of course.
Isn't that corruption?
It is corruption. And I think I raised this with several of the presidential candidates. I spoke to some of their people, and I pointed out to the Clinton example. And I said, if I was in charge, people will go to jail. This is treason, really. When you take money from, especially, you know, I came up with this concept. I don't know if it exists in political science. I call that Carterism, because Carter embodied such example. When a dictatorship, when an absolute monarchy is able to influence the decision of democratically elected leaders through the use of money, that influence, where even the U.S. government would change its domestic or foreign policy that is supposed to be born out of democratic values to meet the demands of dictatorships. That's Carterism.
Where do you see things going between Saudi Arabia and Iran? These are two regional powers. Of course, Iran is larger, a very large military. It's been in a state of sort of non-relationship with the United States since the 1979 revolution. But since the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the so-called Iran nuclear deal, there appears to be in some areas congruence, a thaw of relations. The Saudi monarchy may fear this also, perhaps being replaced by another partner or a semi-partner. Maybe Iran will never be a partner, but a semi-partner in some instances. Does the Saudi monarchy fear for its life at this point?
Absolutely. The Saudis have done this over the past 50 years. Whenever a power emerges, they try to undermine it. They did it with Nasser. They did it even with Iraq. People always talk about, oh, Bush failed with Iraq. Part of the problem is that the Saudis made sure it's failed. That's why they sent over 4,000 Saudi suicide bombers and Al-Qaeda. They funded the Sunni insurgency in Iraq, so to make sure Iraq is never built as a stable democratic or somewhat democratic state government that is representative. It's actually the Iraqi government is one of the most, maybe the most representative government in the Middle East in terms of its diversity, Shia, Sunni, Kurds, Arabs, and so on. So they don't want an example that is successful economically or politically, because that creates problem for them domestically. Imagine what they did for the Muslim Brotherhood. You might not like the Muslim Brotherhood, but Mr. Morsi was elected. They fear that young men in Riyadh think that we can be elected to become the president or the prime minister of our country.
Ali Ahmad, we're out of time. Ali is with the Institute for Gulf Affairs here in Washington, D.C. Thank you so much for joining Loud and Clear. We will be right back.
Loud and Clear. And clear.
Scores of armed supporters of Oregon ranchers Dwight Hammond and his son Stephen, both of whom were sentenced to 5 years in prison by a federal appeals court, have carried out the armed seizure of a federal building, the Malheur Wildlife Refuge, in a remote part of Oregon. We are joined on the phone by Stuart Rhodes. He is the president of the Oath Keepers, and he is a supporter of the so-called Patriot Militia Movement, which rallied behind Nevada rancher Cliven Bundy, who led an armed standoff with federal government forces last year, and whose sons are now leading this armed seizure. They say that they are there to stay for years if necessary. Mr. Rhodes, this is an armed assault on a U.S. federal building. Do you support it?
No, I don't. As we made clear in a statement on Friday, I could tell that Ammon Bundy was going to go beyond, by his public statements, that he was contemplating something beyond a peaceful protest on Saturday. And I warned people that there is no legitimacy in doing that, because the Hammond family has made it very clear that Ammon Bundy does not speak for them, and it made it very clear that Stephen and Dwight Hammond intend on turning themselves in and going back to prison. And so the family has not asked for an armed standoff and does not support one, and neither does the community. And so, yes, we still oppose this. This is a bad idea.
Is this an effort by one wing of the Patriot Militia Movement to provoke an armed confrontation with the federal government, with the Obama administration?
I think this is an attempt by these people, they think they're going to spark the revolution and essentially force the rest of us to come in behind them. I think it's a very, very ill-considered and bad strategy to do it this way. At Bundy Ranch, and we were there at Bundy Ranch, there was imminent threat to the Bundy family of being murdered by federal agents. They had military-trained snipers. They had special forces veteran mercenaries who were there, and that's why we went, to stop them from being killed. Also, it was in defense of their own property rights over their own cattle. This is very different. There's no imminent threat here. The family's not even involved. There's no one that they're defending. They're not defending anyone's private property or life. And they're aggressing. This is the problem. Is they're handing Obama a perfect gift of aggression by the militia that he can point to and say, this is why we need more curtailment of the right to bear arms. It's extremely bad timing. It gives Obama exactly what he would like to have in his hands to justify more curtailment of our rights.
The Obama administration press secretary, Josh Earnest, indicated that the president isn't trying to confront the group, even though they have carried out an armed seizure of a federal building in Oregon. And in fact, I want to quote to you, Josh Earnest, the press secretary, said he's aware of the standoff, but said it's a, quote, local law enforcement matter, despite the fact that it involves federal land. I mean, that indicates, doesn't it, that the Obama administration doesn't see this as some gift for a confrontation that will sort of draw the lines. In fact, that they're trying to have this kind of go away, have it sort of well, dwindle down as a major issue over time.
Because standoff itself, but the other is how he'll use it politically. I'll bet you money, I bet you $100,000, he points to it as an example of why we need expanded background checks or other measures that he's considering. So they will use it politically. He'd be a fool not to, frankly.
I mean, what do you think President Obama would do, say, if the Black Lives Matter seized a federal building with guns?
Well, I don't know. Why don't you go ask him?
No, I'm asking you. I mean, it seems such a tepid response on the part of the federal government. Is, you know, you're presenting President Obama as coming to take down the rights of Americans, and that he's looking forward to this episode. And in fact, it appears that compared to the way the Obama administration has dealt with the Occupy movement, where 7,000 people were arrested when they were having peaceful protests, or thousands have been arrested by the Black Lives Matter, it seems very, very tepid.
The response of local police and the response of the federal government. Where have federal troops or law enforcement gone in and arrested anybody at Occupy Wall Street?
Well, in fact, the federal government coordinated, along with the mayors and local police chiefs all around the country, nationally coordinated crackdown of the Occupy movement in 2011. And all of those documents are now available to the public. I mean, there was a severe crackdown and repression against peaceful protesters who didn't carry guns.
I don't get your point. I don't support that either. I don't support the violation of any American's rights.
Let me ask you about the Clive and Bundy Ranch standoff. You said that was imminently justifiable to go there. There was an armed standoff between your supporters and the federal government. But
was an armed confrontation between the BLM and their contractor,
the Bureau of Land Management, for our listeners. But Clive and Bundy had been grazing cattle, more than 1,000 cattle, for more than 20 years without paying a grazing fees to the federal government. He just stopped paying, and suddenly, like, that became the question of liberty and freedom. I mean, here's a very, very rich rancher. I mean, why was that the throwdown for freedom?
We saw attack dogs being used on cowboys. We saw an old lady being thrown to the ground. We saw these so-called free speech areas they set up, the absurd violations of the First Amendment. But the main reason we went there is we saw, like I said, military-trained sniper teams and special forces veterans being used as contractors. That's what led us to see that they were setting up the possibility of another Waco situation. That's why we went there.
Tell me what the goals are of the Patriot militia movement, in your own words.
Well, I think the goals of most of them are to preserve the Constitution and prevent another Waco. I mean, they rose up after Waco because of the egregious abuse of force that they saw there, military rules of engagement, people being shot and massacred by their own government and burned by their own government. So that's why they rose up, is to stop that kind of thing from happening again. And that is the legitimate and righteous perspective, is to stop that kind of abuse. I think that unfortunately Amnon and his people have done something that's not justified. And like I said, it presents them as the aggressors. I think that was a mistake.
Well, I agree about Waco. I think that was a criminal act by the Justice Department and law enforcement and the illegal criminal destruction of that compound and many, many people, innocent people, many children. That was obviously a terrible crime. And yet it seems to me that like the Hammond case now, you have other extreme right-wing political forces who are taking advantage of that terrible criminal act or the overreach by the federal government in the case of the second sentencing of the Hammonds, for instance, to create a right-wing political movement. You have John Ritzheimer, who is one of the people speaking on the video from this new Bundy occupation in Oregon. He's the one who carried out the armed rallies at mosques in Phoenix, where he announced himself to be the great American crusader against Islam and decided Islam is destroying the American way of life. I mean, is that part and parcel of what your movement stands for? Armed gatherings at mosques.
You can tell by the response of the 3 percenters of Oregon and the 3 percenters of Idaho. Those who put on the rally on Saturday have issued a statement condemning what they did. They said, "Look, this is against our principles. We don't agree with this, and we're not on board." That is the mainstream of the Patriot Movement, along with Oath Keepers, not the outliers who have done this. So Ammon Bundy, unfortunately, surrounded himself with a bunch of hotheads like Ritzheimer, who have their own agenda. This is an individual and a small group of people, not large groups.
I want to ask you, you said before this is exactly the opposite of the Bundy Ranch. You made the case that the Bundy Ranch was a situation where Cliven Bundy and his family was being possibly aggressed against by the federal government, that they had military snipers.
Clearly aggressed against.
Now, if you're asserting that this is sort of just an opportunist effort by right. a wing of your movement to take advantage.
My movement? What do you mean my movement?
Well, is it your movement?
My organization is Oath Keepers, the broader Patriot movement.
I mean, were you together at the Bundy Ranch with the Bundy sons who are now carrying out the armed occupation?
Of course. What they were doing there was good to go. They were defending their own ranch and their own cattle and their own rights.
So a year ago, they were sort of innocents defending themselves against federal government aggression. But a year later, they stage what you describe as an unwarranted armed assault against federal property in defiance of the people,
attacked an occupied building. You can't assault a building that's empty. You can go in and take it over.
So it's not an armed assault. From your point of view, this was not an armed assault on a federal building.
It was an armed takeover. Be accurate. At least be honest.
Okay. Meaning so far shots have not been fired. Is that what you're,
right.
is that, in other words, until shots are fired, it's not really, really an assault. It's just kind of a protest with guns that lock down a building and don't allow the media or the workers to go there.
Assault them. There's no one there.
Well, there's lots of people there. There's lots of people there.
They did at Bundy Ranch. Ammon is wrong on what he's doing now. He's making a tragic mistake.
And what's his, and when you say the Bundys are trying to lead a revolution, is it your revolution? Is it the revolution the Oath Keepers are for? Is it the revolution of a substantial part of the militia movement?
I think there's a large percentage of the American people who understand that the government has now gone far beyond the bounds of the Constitution and we want to rein it in. And I do agree that out west there's been a takeover of our land. When you look at the map, the federal government claims to own an absurd amount of land out west that they have no right to own. The land belongs to the people. So,
well, which people are those, by the way?
But their method is wrong.
Which people are those? I mean, all of that land up until 1877 was land that was controlled by indigenous people, by the Paiute people, by the indigenous and native peoples.
Look at a map of the United States, and you look at Virginia or Massachusetts or any other state on the East Coast. You don't see huge percentages being so-called owned by the federal government. Look at Nevada, it's like 95%. Look at Montana. It's at least 60%.
Okay, so, but Cliven Bundy...
Claimed ownership is the issue.
But Cliven Bundy doesn't own the land, but the federal government does. He doesn't want to pay grazing fees. He says, and I guess you support him, that he refuses to recognize that the United States government even exists. I mean, he says he's not bound by any laws of the United States government.
I don't agree with that, but I do agree with him that that land rightfully belongs to Nevada, and he was willing to pay his grazing fees to the state of Nevada. He recognized it's public land, but his contention is, and I think he's right, that, like I said, it rightfully belongs to the people of Nevada, the state of Nevada, not to the federal government.
Where does Cliven Bundy stand on the standoff? Has he spoken?
All I know is what he said publicly. I think he said he wasn't aware it was going to happen.
Let me ask you this. So Alex Jones, who's, like you, tactically opposed to the takeover, or what I would call as the assault on a federal building. If Black Lives Matter did it, it certainly would be called an assault. But Alex Jones says, like you say, that this is a tactical mistake on the part of your movement, that it really plays into Obama's hands, as
on
you
the
said.
Part of Ammon Bundy.
Right. Yeah. In other words, it's bad timing, bad tactical move. In other words, you're opposing right. it on the basis of tactics, not some fundamental underlying principles.
We should not be the aggressors. I believe in
that's tactics. That's tactics. You prefer to appear to be on the defense or self defense rather than on the offense.
I prefer to be on the defense, not to appear.
Well, that's what you say. I mean, that's your presentation. But let me ask you. Alex Jones says Obama, and this was his critique of the tactics of the takeover. He said this plays into Obama's hands. Obama is taking our guns, and this plays into their plans. The Black Lives Matter and groups telling people to riot, to shoot, to bomb, to kill, because that's the plan to use against each of us, for us to use against each other. Now, that's his critique of this tactic. Do you share, I mean, I don't know of any Black Lives Matter movement saying riot or shoot or bomb or kill, but there's this kind of linkage by your movement against the Black Lives Matter movement, against Black Lives Matter, against the federal government, against immigrants. Is the difference with the people taking over the federal building in Oregon, is it really just about tactics, or do you disagree with what Alex Jones is actually saying here?
Well, I didn't watch that, but I can say that I agree that they are going to use this, as I've said, to try to take more of our rights. I do agree that there's an attempt to divide and conquer the American people along racial lines, if that's what he's saying. I think that's true.
What is that? Explain that. Explain how that's. Explain how that is.
Common interest.
Explain how that plan to divide the American people along racial lines. I mean, the American people were divided along racial lines. There was, in the southern part of the United States, legal apartheid, a segregation until 1964. There was a separation. Then there was the Civil Rights Act and the Black Movement and the Black Lives Matter movement, which are trying to remedy that segregation in American society. But what's the plan now that you see that the Black Lives Matter movement or the U.S. government or others who you are characterizing as the enemy as dividing the country?
The Nation of Islam, for example, which is an overtly racist organization. They always talk about how white people are the devil, et cetera. You've got them coming into the mix, and along with the new Black Panther Party, and they're racist. This is the problem, is that the black community has been represented or presented as being represented by people who are themselves racist. And so we need to set aside race, and then trying to get them to focus on race only.
What actions does the Oath Keepers take that opposes racism directed against black Americans?
Well, we supported the people of Ferguson arming themselves and protecting their own businesses. We supported them peacefully protesting. We warned the Governor Nixon not to violate their First Amendment rights to free to protest. We issued a pretty strong letter against him saying, look, if you violate their rights, eventually you're going to face us in the streets, us veterans. We're not going to let you do this. We opposed the use of pepper spray and rubber bullets and all kind of crap that was being threatened against people in Ferguson.
And how were you received in Ferguson?
Very well. We went down there and guarded black-owned businesses and homes against the looters. And the people who talked to us understood that we were there for the right reasons, counter to the media smear. The media smear made it sound like these white militia guys are inserting themselves against the protesters. We weren't there against the protesters. We were in support of their right to protest. We think there is a problem in America with police abuse. We think it's not just confined to the black community. It's across the board.
Okay, Stuart Rhodes, thank you very much for joining us. We're out of time. Again, we'll be back. We're taking a short break here on Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear. Loud and Clear.
We are back. The police who shot 12-year-old Tamir Rice, shot dead on a playground in Cleveland, playing by himself with a toy gun, they will not be prosecuted. Upon this announcement recently, people took to the streets throughout the United States, as they have been doing over and over again as part of the Black Lives Matter movement. We are joined in studio by Eugene Puryear. Eugene, amongst his many activities, is also a lead organizer of the Stop Police Terror Project in Washington, D.C. Welcome, Eugene.
Thank you so much for having me, Brian.
On New Year's Eve, when lots of people were celebrating, getting ready for the new year, you and others helped organize a really large-scale protest in Washington, D.C. over the failure to prosecute the police officer who shot Tamir Rice and demanding justice for Sandra Bland. Also who died in police custody, an activist who died in police custody. Can you talk about those two cases?
Yes, of course. Well, the Tamir Rice case, which was one of the more signal cases, you could say, in the United States in the past year or so around police brutality, because Mr. Rice was only 12 years old. He was like many, 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 many millions of young people in the United States outside playing with a toy gun in a park. A neighbor called 911 and said, I think there's someone playing with a gun. It's probably a toy gun. You should check it out. The police officer, Officer Lohman and his partner, rolled up on Tamir, made no sort of attempt to use the car's PA system to warn him, jumped out of the car, and in 2 seconds, Officer Lohman gunned him down. And so this was something that many people found just completely outrageous. As the same with the Sandra Bland, and I'm sure we can come back around to some of the details, but that's a lesser known case. And Sandra Bland was someone who, she was a college counselor. She was just getting ready to go on a new job. She was pulled over allegedly for a traffic light violation, although it's important for people to note a lot of times these traffic violations are really just a pretext for racial profiling. And then the officer, she was completely complying with the law. She was smoking a cigarette and the officer asked her to put out the cigarette. Of course, she was under no obligation to do that. And so he starts to threaten her, saying that if you don't put out that cigarette, I'll drag you out of this car and this, that, and the third, all sorts of threats, and then finally arrest her. They arrest her. They take her to this police station. It's still not 100% what is known what happened yet, but she was found dead the next morning in her cell. There's no real video of it. They claim she committed suicide, but this is someone who had no real history of mental health problems or anything like that. And it's a story that doesn't make a lot of sense. But beyond whether or not she was killed in prison, it's 100% clear that she was only there because of an unbelievable case of police misconduct by the officer who pulled her over and arrested her.
And where was that?
That was in Texas.
Okay, so we have Tamir Rice and we have Sandra Bland. I was there in the streets on New Year's Eve here in Washington, D.C. A very large turnout. It was very racially diverse. Black people, Latino people, white people, Asian people, Arab people, young and old. I mean, a really good showing of people on New Year's Eve demanding justice. But we have so many cases where there is no justice. And at a certain point, it must present a quandary or a challenge for the Black Lives Matter movement or the Stop Police Terror Project, which is one part of that broader movement. Where does it go? How does this movement, which is arising and stimulated over and over again by new incidents of police violence, which, again, are almost every day, but how does it sustain itself and how does it become a formidable movement and what are its demands fundamentally?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think there's two layers to it. I mean, one, there's the most obvious layer, which was how do we try to deal with how the police are interacting with everyone, but certainly with young black males and others on a day in, day out basis? Are there ways that they can be curbed to a degree, that greater accountability can put in there. And I think what we're seeing around the country is a lot of people working towards police review boards with more right to fire, changing the protocols of how the police deal with people on a day-to-day basis. But more importantly, and I think this is something that's important to note, that the mainstream media in America has completely ignored. The only national gathering of the Black Lives Matter movement so far happened last year, last July, 2015, and it was actually called the Movement for Black Lives Conference. And the reason that's relevant, convening rather, the reason that's relevant is because what a lot of people are starting to see in this movement, and I think it's demonstrably true, is that the issue of the police isn't so much an issue of the police have the wrong attitude or they're bad people or whatever it may be, but the entire function of what they are doing is inherently adversarial. You have these communities that have been completely economically hollowed out. You put the police in there to essentially be the people who hold the lid on a boiling over pot, to really be a military solution to the social problem that's being created by economic devastation. And then ultimately, there's only one way that can work out, is us versus them. When the police are saying, we're here to enforce the law, but many people who live in these communities say, well, these things that are allegedly against the law, that is essentially, you know, how we survive and how we get by in the gray market, the black market, the crevasses of the economy, because many of those people, young black former prisoners, are shut out. And that we have to start to deal, then that means it's inherently adversarial. Those two things can't go together. And we have to start to deal with that, which is why we start to see, to sustain itself, this movement is looking more and more to dealing with housing issues, employment issues, job issues, education issues, because they recognize that, and we recognize that policing is not just about policing, but it really is symptomatic of the overall economic devastation existing in many black communities in America.
So you're saying that policing is really not about crime, it's about social control by the powers that be, the economic or political elites, at a time when vast parts of the country that at one time had prospering or at least thriving industries, you look at Detroit, for instance, or many of the industrial cities, which are now, as you put it, hollowed out, those corporate entities have gone elsewhere to where wages are lower, first in the South or maybe later in the South, but also to Mexico or to China or wherever. So you have what appears to be a big part of the American population that's not necessary for employment. In other words, the corporations don't really need them. And the decision to employ or not to employ really rests with the corporations, with the same corporate elites. So they use the police as an instrument of social control to quote police, but really to suppress or repress entire communities. Is that what explains, and this is what I'm getting at, what explains the failure of even liberal politicians when they have some authority, like Mayor de Blasio in New York, who came into office against the egregious stop and frisk policy, where hundreds of thousands, literally black and Latino kids, were stopped and frisked without any probable cause that they had committed a crime, and they were frisked, and their data was collected. And yet, when he came into office on the basis and elected on the basis that he would bring substantial reform, he seems to have completely stepped back. Is that an individual defect, a defect of de Blasio, or is there something systematic, as I think you're suggesting, that makes all of the political politicians succumb?
Mm-hmm. I think it's absolutely systematic. I mean, certainly I'm sure many of these people who are politicians who are succumbing don't have the right motives. But even if you do, I mean, you really, there's no second option for them, because they've been elected on the backs of people who spend lots and lots of money. Their whole design is to you know, do what these donors want them to do, essentially. And many of them will say, oh yeah, we do need more affordable housing, we do need more jobs, but not too much. Because once it starts to erode the profit margin, once it starts to erode the ability of developers to build these new gentrifying apartment buildings and things like that, then you have a real problem on your hands. And so when you're talking about what it will take, I mean, you've got Barack Obama saying after Baltimore, well, we have to deal with the devastation in the inner city. But when you've got a situation where 50% of the people are unemployed, where large numbers of people, I was in Baltimore, I went to one neighborhood, one single neighborhood, where one Narcotics Anonymous meeting had 600 people every single week. So when you're dealing with social problems that are so deep, that at this point are multi-generational, you're talking about millions and millions and millions of jobs. When this is an economy that, forget who we're talking about can only create a couple hundred thousand jobs a month when you'd actually have to create a few million a month just to keep up with population growth. So the scale of what needs to happen to really solve these social problems is so great. It's actually beyond the systemic reality of this system to actually solve. And I think you see politicians who talk a good game, but then they look at, okay, well, what's our other alternative? And it's so far outside of the political reality they can't do it.
Well, you have, you know, 70,000 bridges in America that need repair. That's not according to me or you. It's according to the U.S. government's own assessment. Roads need to be repaired. There's huge infrastructure problems in the United States. The United States has become an older society infrastructure-wise. In other words, there is the need for jobs. There is the need for employment. And yet you have millions and millions, tens of millions of people who are almost permanently unemployed. They perhaps turn to drugs or other things either to survive or to survive psychologically. Then society blames the people for not achieving. Why can't, when we have all of this unmet economic need, why can't there be a massive jobs program that really erases unemployment? Why could that happen, first of all? And if so, why doesn't it happen?
Well, I think theoretically it can happen, but it doesn't happen for two reasons. There's only one way this is going to happen, and that's for a lot of money to be spent. In a capitalist society, the government does not control the vast majority of investable funds. Private businesses, banks, hedge funds, whatever, they all control it. So the government will either A, have to drastically increase taxes on rich people and control more wealth, which I think we've seen is something that is very difficult to do in our current political climate, because if you're making a lot of money, why would you give more up unless you absolutely had to? Or two, for the entities themselves to do this investment. But the reality is that the return on investments, the profitable return on investment, is not really high enough in most of these areas to justify to those people the type of profits they would want to make to do the investing. That's why you see so much money going into Wall Street, flooding into the stock market in a few specific areas, because it's a desire to find high levels of returns, primarily that were sort of goosed sort of post-2001 with the dot-com boom. And they're looking for these high returns. They can't get them. They're certainly not going to invest in something that's going to get them a low return when they can invest in something that will get them a slightly higher return. So you got it on both ends. They don't want to pay higher taxes. They don't want to invest the money. So in the context of the capitalist system, which has to have private businesses and entities invest the money, there isn't the political will amongst those forces to want to invest, because they don't have to. If you have $100 million, you can take a helicopter. You're not worried about a bridge.
True enough. I want to ask you about the issue of the status of Black America 7 years after the election of the first African-American president. When Barack Obama was elected, it was a shock. I mean, I think everyone could not have, or no one anticipated, that a Black man could be elected president even a few years or perhaps even a few months before he got the Democratic nomination in the summer of 2008. And he won. And then there was a lot of talk that election signaled that America had entered a post-racial society. That, in other words, Black people now really, by evidence of Barack Obama's election, Black people had opportunity now, and that white people in America were not so deeply racist that they wouldn't support a Black man to be the president of the United States. Your own assessment about Obama's impact as a person, or even more importantly, his administration, on the actual social and economic status of the Black community in America, 35, 40 million people, a very large, larger than most countries in the world, is the population of Black America. And yet the problems seem to be endemic and so stubborn not to have been altered, or perhaps maybe even worsened.
Yes, I mean, I think that is the case. It has worsened in a lot of ways. I mean, the statistic I like to use the most is that, you know, of Black college graduates, that's college graduates with bachelor's degrees, just over 50% of them are now working in jobs that don't require a 4-year college degree. So even the people who, you know, took the alleged opportunity that was out there, I mean, you're looking at most Black communities in inner cities in America having 20+%, sometimes 50% unemployment. I live in a neighborhood in Washington, D.C., the nation's capital, mostly Black neighborhood, almost 50% child poverty. And so I think what we're seeing is that Obama looked at this and he said in the beginning, I'm not the president of Black America. I'm the president of the United States of America, and I can't put in special programs just for Black people. But the irony of that is that the job market is not just one big pool. It's sectoral, and it has a lot of different strata and elements that go into it. And so the reason there's higher structural unemployment for Black Americans is very much related to racism in the labor market and other phenomena like that, which have to actually be dealt with specifically, or they cannot really be addressed. But President Obama, because he didn't want to seem like he was the Black president, but that he wanted to sort of transcend and be post-racial, seemed almost allergic in his first term and a little bit in his second to actually looking at how the same way that his administration looks at veterans unemployment. They say, well, there's a number of very specific factors that lead veterans to be unemployed, and thus we need to have very specific veterans employment, housing programs, or whatever. He refuses to do that for Black Americans, primarily to avoid invoking the false wrath of the Republican Party saying, oh, well, you're only doing things for Black people and so on and so forth.
I mean, that's such an interesting and maybe a dilemma, a paradox that is not overcomable by Barack Obama, the person, or any Black person who had the office of the presidency. He doesn't want to appear as, quote, the president of Black America because he doesn't want to look to the white, to white America as if he's giving preference to Black people, which is, of course, the main allegation of white racism, that Black people have been a privileged minority and not an oppressed minority. And at the same time, while he's unable to do that, his opponents really have galvanized a massive groundswell of opposition, really based on the fact, I think, that he's a Black man who's running mm-hmm. America, or at least they've used that as the rallying cry for, I'd say, latent or not latent, but a kind of white supremacist current in American politics that at least has been a little bit in the closet and is now pretty much out of the closet. What do you think?
Oh, I think that's 100% true. I mean, you know, they were going to use it one way or another. And the political strategies, I mean, I think, you know, we could do a whole hour long show on what the Obama administration has been doing. But I think that's 100% the case. And I think that what we've seen is that Obama also is promoting a false narrative to a certain degree by saying that these things are mutually exclusive, that you can't have you couldn't have a veterans program, a Black program, a women's program, all sort of sectorally targeted youth towards getting those sectors more employed. You could easily do all of those things. All at once, but in fact, he really gave in for, you know, I think a whole range of reasons to this.
Let me ask you in our last 45 seconds, we had the Civil Rights Act of 64, the Voting Rights Act of 65, Lyndon Johnson's Great Society, Richard Nixon, even the right winger yep. proposing many social programs and affirmative action.
Philadelphia Plan.
And yet poverty and oppression and the suppression based on police forces continues to be the dominant problem facing Black America in addition to poverty. Is there the promise or the possibility that the Black Lives Matter, I'm only left you 15 seconds now or 10, is there the promise that the Black Lives Matter movement can evolve into a monumental movement like the 1960s civil rights movement? Is it possible?
In one word, yes. We've seen this movement be extremely critical of capitalism, structural realities of capitalism, and even raise the issue of revolution. And I think just putting those big ideas into the political firmament really gives the opportunity to create big political movements based on important organizing principles.
Okay, Eugene Puryear, we have run out of time. I want to thank you. That's Eugene Puryear from the Stop Police Terror Project in Washington, D.C. We will be back tomorrow. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We are out of here.
Loud and clear.